this case, we had a committee meeting about 3 months ago at Channel 9, and John Doherty, being one of our committee members, we were discussing who we might get along in a program that was coming up. And our big battle is always finding good guest speakers, which is why we're lucky to have the one we've got today. John Doherty suggested that we should address the issue, John Doherty being the news director of Nine, suggested we should address the issue of the growing divide between the rich and the poor in Australia. And we all thought this was a pretty good idea, and we immediately decided that the best person to do it was the Reverend Tim Costello, who's been very, very vocal on this issue in recent times. Tim was educated at Monash University, at Rushlikon in Switzerland, at the Baptist Theological College there, at Whitby College in Melbourne. He also has a law degree, interestingly, which I think your brother does, Tim, is that correct? And has worked in the law firm, very briefly, I think. He was the mayor of St Kilda from 1993 to 1994, and he's also a delegate to the Constitutional Convention. He just remarked to me that while we don't have a republic, he has become a president of the Baptist Union of Australia, thank you. So he's a president in a non-republic. He was given a National Living Treasure Award in 1997. He's the author of a number of books, including Streets of Hope and the latest, Tips from a Travelling Soul Searcher, which you might have noticed is on sale outside the front here, and Tim is happy to sign it if you want to buy it. I'll just quote from the back of the jacket. Thousands of Australians can't hear enough from the Reverend Tim Costello. Across the continent and beyond, they ask him to speak in churches, schools, conferences and in the media. In times when materialism and competition threaten to overwhelm what we used to hold dear, he senses a common cry, what can we do? Tim, what can we do?
Thanks for the welcome, and it's a great pleasure to be here. I always love coming to Adelaide, which is a wonderfully laid out city, and I have some good friends here, some of who are here today, so it's a pleasure in every sense to be here. It's also been great to enjoy a good lunch together, and I hope the wines don't put you to sleep. If you start snoring, someone will wake you up. I heard of a husband and wife who'd been in church listening to the sermon. The husband, as I was driving home, said to his wife, you know, I think I'm actually suffering from insomnia. And the wife said, why is that, darling? She said, he said rather, I woke up twice during that sermon. Well, I hope you can stay awake for some of this. All societies live by dominant stories. The dominant story in Australia at the moment is the story of wealth to happiness. It's a story that most Australians plug into, which says the wealthier I am, the more happy I will be. It's interesting that though this story is fairly universal at the moment, it's not the only story that we've told about ourselves. Most of us have grown up on the stories of Australia being a social laboratory, an egalitarian society, a society which rejected the them and us, the class distinctions of Britain, a storyline that suggests that we are trying something different. That story has some evidence to it. It's the evidence of some of the most remarkable experiments in political and civic democracy anywhere in the world. We as a nation were the first country to introduce the secret ballot. So the rich couldn't buy votes, so that the powerful couldn't intimidate people to get their votes. The secret ballot was known as the Australian ballot. It was a breathtaking innovation. Surprised the world. When we had a conciliation and arbitration system introduced, Mr. Justice Higgins in the Sunshine Harvester case in 1907, ruled on what was called a family wage, later a basic wage. He included in his calculations not just the rent, the food, the clothes, the working man, and then it was mainly the working man would need for his family and himself, he included the cost of a daily newspaper. When asked why later, he said, well, how else will the working man who here must shape decision making, know what his leaders are doing, influence them, how will he know what's going on if he can't afford a newspaper? Such was the notion of citizenship. As many of you know, we had the first Labour government in the world. The world was gobsmacked. Socialists had come to power democratically. Funnily enough, that first Labour government was in Queensland. In 1899, it only lasted 7 days, but there it was. First Labour government in the world. We were a country that were one of the first to give women the right to vote, to stand for Parliament, and here in South Australia, you actually led the way. We were the first country to introduce proportional representation, saying minorities should be represented. Again, this was quite extraordinary. We defined ourselves as a nation that said we're on about a fair go for battlers. Mateship became a word to capture that spirit. This was a story that rejected class, aristocracy, them and us in Britain. Of course, we now know that mateship and a fair go didn't include women or Chinese or Indigenous. We have started to address those blind spots. With the rise of feminism in the 60s, we started to address that. At least we addressed the women issue a little bit with the right to vote and right to stand for Parliament. With the issue of our White Australia policy, our xenophobia, I understand that on a Melbourne talkback show, someone was asked to win the prize, I think it was $200, what xenophobia was. That person thought for a while and said, oh, I know, it's fear of pokies. I think Nick Xenophon's sister, who lives in Melbourne, heard that and was quite tickled. The questioner didn't have a clue what that was about. That's a very South Australian answer. Well, we, with multiculturalism, have started to address the xenophobia, to address certainly the White Australia policy. And now, though it has been 9-10 long years, we are starting to address the blind spot in terms of Indigenous reconciliation. It is extraordinary, isn't it, that even 8 years ago, in AFL football, which has been one of the most important cultural vehicles to actually challenge racism, the Collingwood fans throwing racial taunts at Nicky Wimmer watched with amazement as he raised his jumper and pointed proudly at his black skin. It's pretty amazing that Michael Long, who, by the way, plays for the best football team in the competition, Michael Long did the unthinkable. He broke what's the equivalent in league culture to sort of the mafia's omerta, the code of silence. You roll on to the tribunal, and it's amazing from Saturday to Tuesday what amnesia sets in with AFL footballers. No, I don't remember being hit. No, I don't remember who that was. Michael Long stood up and he said, I do remember what was said. I do remember being racially abused. Long, not knowing whether he would be totally ostracised for breaking this code of silence. And Damien Monkhurst, the Collingwood footballer, now St Kilda, in question, being just amazed. What did I do wrong? But surely that can't be racism. We all say that. Nick Malthouse, last week in The Age, saying Chris Lewis, Aboriginal footballer for the Eagles, was one of the most talented footballers he had ever seen. He never reached his potential, Malthouse said, because early in his career, opponents discovered Lewis could be put off his game very easily. He had an Achilles heel. You only had to taunt him racially. Malthouse said Lewis never learnt to cope with that. How the AFL finally took a stand. How just in 1993, an alternative Aboriginal walking trail in Melbourne that was different to the statutes of Queen Victoria and John Batman and Burke and Wills and all the statutes that are there was being prohibited by the Melbourne City Council. In fact, then it was a commissioner. You might have heard of him, Kevin Gosper. being prohibited because Gosper and the Melbourne City Council didn't want a guilt trail. How in the short years since the early 90s we've actually moved so far. Yes, we haven't got a Prime Minister who has the emotional resonance to go the full distance and to walk the bridge and to say the S word, but the numbers who did walk the bridge say very clearly we are facing our history. We're actually overcoming at last, as we've done with women's rights and with xenophobia, we're overcoming this extraordinary blind spot. In the Melbourne Age, in 1998, Lang Dean wrote this letter. My father was a Victorian policeman from 1922 until 1946. He spent a long spell of duty at Echuca. The rail workers came to Echuca to spend their earnings and let off steam. My father made 343 arrests on average in those years. He was a good and conscientious policeman. During 1937 to 1938, when I was 7 or 8 years old, he would sometimes come off duty and, as was his custom, sit on a stool outside our kitchen take off his helmet. On occasions he would be crying and sobbing like a child. I would be upset to see such a strong man cry, and I asked him why. He said he would not tell me, as I was too young to understand, but he would tell me when I grew up. What he did say then was, son, don't ever become a policeman. It's a dirty job. After he left the force when I was about 16 years old, he and I were camping on a fishing trip, and we were sitting around the campfire. I'd often thought about how Dad cried years ago, so I asked him would he tell me the reason. He told me that when he was on duty those mornings, his sergeant would order him to accompany two welfare officers to Kamaragunga, a mission station, to give them bodily protection. When they entered, nice, clean, simple homes of half-caste people, and bodily removed 9, 10, 11 and 12-year-old children from loving fathers and loving mothers in commandeered taxis. They were taken to Echuca railway station and then sent to the far reaches of New South Wales and Queensland. They were fanned out to service wealthy businessmen and graziers. No doubt a few, he writes, were treated well, but the rest would be thrown on the human scrap heap when finished with. He finishes this letter simply with the phrase, "So that's the reason my father cried on those days." After the weekend, most Australians actually know that the widening gap, ever widening gap between black and white, isn't a question of money. It isn't simply a question of practical reconciliation, as important as that is. That when people have internalised the picture that they are lazy or stupid or dirty, when they have been removed from families so there was no chance for them to have bonding and learn parenting skills, the self-esteem, the culture are fundamentally critical to poverty, to alcoholism, to a sense of worthlessness, to a loss of meaning. After the weekend, I think Australians are starting now to recognise that the widening gap will require practical policies of reconciliation in health and education. But at last, Indigenous people are hearing mainstream European Australia declare, "We understand what we did to you." And most of us are starting to use that old-fashioned biblical word, we repent. Repentance isn't just saying sorry, though that's where it starts. It's actually turning around, saying we've gone in the wrong direction. Our policies pre-1945 were racial assimilation. Policies where Aboriginal people were recorded like livestock, full blood, who married or mated with an octoroon, therefore the child is a quadroon, must not be allowed to marry and mate with anyone with coloured blood. After the defeat of Hitler and his obvious racial assimilationist and destructive policies, breeding the colour out was dropped from public policy statements and it became cultural assimilation. Of course, how would they learn to read and write and have a chance if we didn't remove them? Well, we are starting to understand that the widening gap isn't simply a matter of money. Yes, there has been a lot of money directed to Indigenous people, but it's a question of hope. It's a question of self-esteem. It's a question of knowing that when you have been damaged and hurt, until full recognition, full repentance is offered, it's very hard to pick yourself up again, to believe that your story and pain has been honoured and you can move on. The widening gap, of course, is not just with our Indigenous people. The widening gap is increasingly between the cities and rural Australia. The Age this morning carries a story. Rural Victoria has the nation's lowest earners. Victoria's small townships are the poorest places in Australia. The average households in the state's small country towns live on barely half the income of the average household in Canberra. This latest analysis is shown from the Centre for Social and Economic Modelling. It's based on the census data. It goes through and talks about the salary differences. We know in Australia that there is now talk of health and death by postcode. That your postcode can actually predict what your levels of health and wealth will actually be. We have this extraordinary conundrum of wonderful growth and wealth and very prosperous communities, and embedded in between them, impoverished communities where there is, on the misery index, only pain, people going backwards. Well, what does this do to the Australian story, that we are a social laboratory? Clearly, it has been supplanted, I think, by the wealth to happiness story. The story that says greater economic growth will mean that everybody will benefit. This is a fairly unsatisfactory story. We now know that from most empirical surveys, and there's been many done, that wealth is a very poor predictor of happiness. It doesn't mean that poverty is a good predictor of happiness, but wealth is a very poor predictor of happiness. The people who are wealthier commonly say, but I still feel I haven't got enough. There's the wonderful story told of J.D. Rockefeller Sr., the founder of the empire, fabulously rich, working very hard, working so hard he wasn't seeing his wife and children. And Rockefeller was confronted by a very smart journalist who said, "Mr. Rockefeller, how much money does it take to make a man happy?" He answered, "Just a little more." That restlessness has become part of the problem in the growing gap between rich and poor. Because wealth rarely is just about happiness. Wealth is about belonging. It's about brand. It's about label. Advertisers say to us, "You tell us who your people are, we'll tell you what cars they drive, where they dine, where they holiday, what schools their kids go to. We'll tell you what sort of houses you should be living in and how they should be equipped. You want to be belonging to that group? We'll give you the brand. We'll reconstitute community that's fragmenting through brand." Of course, this is very pernicious with those who are poor, and particularly children. In St Kilda, where I live, there are many kids who have single parents who can't afford the brand names like Nike. Brands that mean those children feel culturally excluded. They don't belong. And if they steal, often they're charged, as they should be, with theft. And I've gone to court, and by the way, Robert, I still am a practicing lawyer and do a little bit of law on the side still. I go off to court. I am often representing in the children's court these kids. Our children's court has a plaque, a very fine plaque, that says the future will judge us by how we treat our children. It's in a very small shoebox of a building. It's right opposite Crown Casino, which occupies two city blocks. I listen to magistrates wag their finger at my client when I'm there, saying theft is wrong, you mustn't steal. I'm often thinking, you know, who's the real victim here? They've been targeted by the most brilliant advertising minds, saying you will only belong if you have these labels, by Michael Jordan, who says just do it, love these ads. They're not persuasive. They're just very authoritarian, aren't they? Just do it. And when they've just done it, they've stuck, Nike under their jumper, they end up in court, and a magistrate says, and they should say, you've got to learn from this. Don't try and get something for nothing. Don't take shortcuts. And there, right up it said, those children's political leaders have built, and in past times with ex-Premier Kennett, promoted a gaming culture whose whole values say, try and get something for nothing. Take a shortcut. And I often think, the problem with our kids isn't that they don't have our values, the problem is they do have our values. The values of a wealth to happiness, take a shortcut. The values of a increasingly, in a globalised world, winner-loser culture, where it's a very fine slip, a knife-edge slip, between being a loser as opposed to being a winner. That's why the possibility of drugs, the possibility of suicide becomes real options. When you internalise the picture that you're a loser in a culture that's on about avoiding pain, about trying to take shortcuts, drugs become a shortcut. It's very interesting, the 60 or 70 kids we feed each day of the week at Collins Street, many of them drug affected, have internalised the picture they're a loser. It's one of the reasons I speak out against the gaming culture, by the way, because it's cleverly intensifying this paradigm. Crown Casino's slogan, at Crown, everybody's a winner. I'd never realised that everybody won. Apparently they were a winner, Crown. But here in this culture, the young kids who we're feeding on drugs will often say very perceptive things. They'll say, it's drugs that give me meaning in life. With $100 or $200 or $300 a day habit, I've got purpose. Whether it's burgling or scamming or scoring, I'm actually out there doing something. And by the end of the day, I know if I've been a success or not. In a culture that says if you can't measure it, it's not real. If you can't benchmark it, it doesn't exist. This drug scoring actually fits the cultural paradigm. And when you get them off drugs, as we do with a number, thankfully, they say, what am I going to do? Where's the purpose? They look at their parents and they say, my parents are glad I'm off drugs, but I don't want to be like them. Look at my parents. They've got to have a diary to make a dinner date to see their friends. No one drops by. On the street, there are people to hang out with, laugh with, celebrate with, score with. In other words, they're saying there was community, there was presence, there was relationship. They're questioning the dominant cultural story of wealth to happiness. A story driven increasingly by the ethic of competitive individualism. We're all competing, standing on the shoulders of others, trying to be happier as we run faster. Sadly, that ethic means that we say increasingly my only duty to anybody else in society is to do whatever is in my best interests. This competitive individualistic culture, driving a wealth to happiness story, needs to be unpacked and unmasked. Richard Neville, in a very good article, said, what if Socrates had been in a hurry? Instead of strolling around barefoot, chatting to layabouts while cooking up Western civilization, what if he had zoomed about on Nike tailwinds, gulping baroccas, a Nokia phone pressed to his ear, surfing a palm top? Would he have uttered anything worthwhile? He goes on and adds, and this is perhaps more true for us than the kids we feed, people worry about heroin, but the most popular drug of addiction today is adrenaline. The enemy of leisure, the thief of time, the destroyer of community and relationships. As the information age gathers momentum, so do we. The quicker time disappears, the fiercer grows our impatience. I think that's a very important challenge to us. It reminds us that in this hyperculture of individualism, we actually have to look at the cultural story. The cultural story that we do need to look at, if the gap isn't to continue widening, is a story that says Australians, rather than boasting about being the greatest gamblers in the world or the greatest drinkers in the world, can pick up that original story of saying, what if we aim to have the most just and fair and transparent society in the world? What if that became the question of identity for us? What if it said true wealth is in community? It is in spirituality, the privatising of the soul that says when you struggle with spiritual matters, it's just an inner wrestle with your own conscience and your own story, has meant in society at large, we've often not said that it's a spiritual issue to be fundamentally concerned about reconciliation, about the environment, because the self isn't just a privatised individual, it actually relates to the environment. To actually live by this story might be to find true happiness, to find different wealth. I think our drug levels, even our suicide levels, show us that there is deep dysfunction within the culture. The fragmentation in the culture is great. People are longing for community. Witness the numbers who watch Neighbours. It's interesting that nearly a million Australians watch Neighbours each night of the week. Most of those don't actually know their next door neighbours. Does that strike you as curious? We watch Sea Change, Bellicus Angel, we long for community. Yet, we're running faster doing the very things that don't cause us to find community. We have to look at the story. When I was at university, met my wife in the mid-70s, we were told in the mid-70s the really major issue we were going to face come the 1990s was what would we do with all our leisure and recreation time? Would we be prepared? As we were talking about this, she said, gee, they lied to us, didn't they? We thought about it more and we said, no, they didn't lie. They were right. If she and I were prepared to live with what we had in the 70s, we would have to only work 20 hours a week and have time to plant trees and do the things with our kids we want to do and be community builders. But we expect dishwashers and dryers and microwaves. We expect phones and computers and maybe an overseas trip every 3 or 4 years. Our expectations keep rising. We run faster. The wealth, the happiness story keeps going. And we feel more insecure and lost. This means that the wealth to community and relationship story needs an airing. When you ask Australians this question, and I've been looking here for Richard Eckersley's figures, I just can't quite turn them up, but Eckersley says that most Australians, when asked, here they are, Richard Eckersley in his survey, Perspectives on Progress, says the vast majority of Australians say that things aren't getting better, that they're more insecure, public trust has fallen, that young people who want a greener, more stable society as their preferred future expect a more fast-paced, individualistic, competitive and greedy society. Most, when asked, don't actually believe this story, and yet we find it very difficult to have a sophisticated political conversation to say, what are our heart hungers? What are our real values? If we can have that conversation, then budgets, whether they're federal, state or local, are simply a statement of those priorities. That's all a budget is. A statement of those values. Yes, we want enterprise. Yes, we want some growth. But we're 10 times richer than our grandparents at the turn of the century. At John Howard's projected 3-4% economic growth, we'll be 20 times richer than we are now at the end of this next century. But what does that actually mean in terms of real community, health and happiness? Let me finish by encouraging you to be people who look at the stories that dominate your own life, the stories that dominate the culture. Listen to your kids. My kids have taught me so much. If I can finish with a personal story about the culture, I was quite shocked when I pulled up at a self-serve station with my kids in the car and my wife in the front to get out, put the petrol in, walk over and pay, receive my change, get back in the car and realise I'd gone through the whole transaction without paying, exchanging any words. And I thought, that's pretty impersonal. And I had a flashback to when I was a kid. Mum and Dad in the FJ Holden we had, three kids in the back, Dad pulling up at a garage, him getting out, lifting up the bonnet, looking under it. But Dad was a teacher, so he didn't have a clue what he was looking at. He was waiting for the attendant to come over. He would eventually come. It was often inefficient. But the attendant would do oil, water, petrol, of course, air. What I remember was my father would always have a conversation with different attendants, total strangers. He'd ask about football, he'd ask about weather, they'd talk sometimes about politics. My father was a politics teacher. As you know, there's a tad of politics in the family. I remember as a kid thinking, how does he know what to say? This is a stranger. How does he know what to talk about? And then thinking, that's pretty neat. I hope when I'm older I can do that. Then I thought, gee, my kids don't see me doing that. What am I modelling to them? It's all so efficient. Next time I had my kids in tow, it was at a McDonald's. To be honest, my kids don't like being seen in public with me now they're teenagers. But they will come if I'm paying at McDonald's. I thought, I'm going to learn from this. I walked up and the young woman at the counter, her name was Karen. So I said, before we ordered, hi Karen, are you having a nice day? She looked shocked. I said, oh, my name's Tim. You don't know my name. I said, do you work after school or full time? She said, oh, no, it's full time. I said, oh, that's good. And are they training you to manage a place like this, or what are your dreams? She said, oh, no, and she started to talk about what she wanted to do. And I thought, this is good. It's a commercial transaction, but there's also a relationship here. So I just turned around to see that my children were absorbing this magnificent community moment that I was modelling. To my embarrassment, they'd gone. They walked straight on. I walked out, I found them. I got them back in, we got our food and sat down. My daughter looked at me and she said, you are such a nerd. I said, why? She said, why are you trying to humiliate us? You're not meant to talk to her. You're not meant to call her by name. I said, well, if I'm not meant to talk to her and call her by name, why has she got a name tag on? My daughter said, she's got a name tag on so that if she stuffs up, you know who to report. Well, the penny dropped for me. It's sort of funny, but it's sort of sad. We've unhinged relationship and community even from commercial relations. It's all about performance. It's all about efficiency. Where do we actually model and mentor and connect? Where are the forums? The alternative stories that this nation has lived by are still there. Over the weekend, I think we started to face them. We started to reconcile what I reckon is the real issue, not black-white reconciliation. That's yet to come, I reckon. It's white European reconciliation, because the mirror we've always looked at ourselves as a nation has come back. We're our nation about a fair go and battlers. And we've looked in the mirror, thanks to the history that now has been revealed, and looking back at us has been a nation in its policies that has been racist. And we can't reconcile ourselves with that image. That's the huge dilemma. We're saying that's not us. That can't be us. Well, there is still, within our own story, the alternative dream of being a just and transparently fair society. I invite you to be part of that. Thank you.
When I was working in America many years ago, William Safire, the columnist in the New York Times, wrote a column which I've always remembered, and he was talking about the American habit of saying, or people who were serving you saying, have a nice day, or enjoy your meal. And he came back with what I thought was the equally meaningless response that he would give, which was, thank you, I will if I do. I should have told you in my introductory comments that one of the things that Tim Costello lists in his entry in Who's Who as a recreation, I think, Tim, isn't it, is speaking. and I think you understand why now. Tim, I'll thank you further in a moment. In the meantime, we have questions, starting in our usual way with questions from media members of the club.
I want to ask about the growing numbers of single mothers and the responsibility they have bringing up their children, often in very difficult circumstances. What do you think can be done with two things? First of all, a federal government which isn't altogether encouraging women to remain in the workforce and build an independent future. And the other thing is the image that is still surrounding young women on their own who often are victims trying to rebuild their lives with a stigma attached.
As a parent, where there's my wife and I bringing up three kids and knowing the extraordinary stresses of just coping with two of us, I take my hat off to any single parent. They need every support that we can give. And I think when we acknowledge the reality in this country, as in all countries, that the high mobility of life means that more and more people find relationships break down. The stresses upon us that make it very difficult for people, it seems, to stay with their primary commitments. I think we must, as a nation, say children shouldn't suffer. Children who don't choose to come into the world should not ever be the ones who suffer in order to teach some lesson to parents, single parents, that they should have been more responsible or their marriage shouldn't have broken down or whatever. I think that's not a just or fair society. And clearly, to say that suggests that we've got to find proper ways of funding those parents who are single parents and do stay home. I think, and I was alluding to this, that poverty is not nearly as absolute as 30 or 40 or 50 years ago, but its cultural pain is still as great. If you don't have spending power, you really become invisible. It's as if you cease to exist. And for single parents and their kids particularly who can't enjoy the things that all their friends have, it becomes a very deep cultural pain. And I think most of us who want lower taxes and ever-increasing disposable income have to really ask ourselves some fundamental questions about who's bearing the brunt in terms of cuts to social spending for those choices we have. When you really honestly ask yourself what you need, you're often surprised. Like each Christmas I ask myself the question, what do I really need for Christmas? And then I say, what do I actually buy for loved ones and friends who already have everything? And the dilemma is to find a Christmas gift for people who actually have everything. That's the dilemma. So increasingly I have been writing letters to friends and sometimes family, saying, look, the money I was going to spend on your Christmas present this year I've given to World Vision or Community Aid Abroad. I hope you don't mind. Isn't it great we've discovered the true meaning of Christmas? It doesn't always get a clap from me. But it seems to me that as a nation we could be doing that also. We could be saying where there are single parents who are struggling to bring up kids with the enormous responsibilities for that and the poverty their kids have, we should never be stigmatising them as a nation and cutting back in terms of their income supports.
Well, the next question is from Rex Joy, the Deputy Editor of the Adelaide Advertiser.
Okay, I've got three questions, totally unrelated. The first is, we're listening to the top this year. The second is...
Any other easy questions?
This is more difficult. This is the question everyone wants to ask. How do you get on with your brother? The third question is, and it's probably more serious, why have charity donations to people like the Red Shield Appeal, for example, and St Vinny's and Anglicare and so on, why have they fallen off? Why have they dropped away? Why can't the Salvation Army get anywhere near its targets when we are in pretty much boom times in Australia?
Well, let me answer the first two questions together. Yes, Essendon will certainly be top. I should say that I was over here just before the Crows St Kilda Grand Final, and I was speaking, and having been the Mayor of St Kilda, I thought I would just have a little joke saying to some press here, saying that I had a dream before I arrived, and the dream was me being translated to a land covered in darkness, and blighted, miserable people who had never seen the sun for 20 years. And in my dream, as I was transported to this land, I saw a saint walk into this country. And the saint restored light because the sun had been blotted out by huge flocks of ugly black crows. I must say that nobody laughed. Anyway, Essendon will be top, and my brother and I, who both barrack for Essendon, get on very well. The next question is serious. When we are much better off than our parents, even our grandparents, why are donations to charities down? Two reasons, I think. The first is, though we are much better off, we don't feel better off. We feel much more insecure. Most Australians figure if they've got a job, it's probably only because their employer hasn't worked out how to do without them yet. And it's only a matter of time. That means, when it's contracts, that rather than giving regularly and generously, you know, to the salvos or whatever it might be you give to, you think, I better salt that money away. I might have a job now, but it's only for a year. How long is it going to be between contracts? That insecurity makes us much more self-protective and far less generous. The second reason has to do with government policy. Increasingly, it was the salvos or World Vision out there trying to get money. These days, it's schools and hospitals and lots of things that were funded out of the public purse are all chasing that same dollar. I had an interesting cultural revelation when I drove through St Kilda Junction. I was standing, sorry, in St Kilda Junction collecting for a youth suicide group called Here for Life, and this Nigerian man in my congregation pulled up in a car, and I sort of rattled the tin under his nose and he put a coin in. Next day at church, he came up to me and he said, how did your begging go? And I thought, culturally, that's right, it was begging. Now, that's what it is. Now, I think we've got to, again, have a sophisticated conversation about what should be funded and what, therefore, legitimately should be a claim on the charitable dollar, because at the moment, the competition is just much too tight.
Hi, Nicole Blood from Advertiser. I was just wondering what impact you think the GST will have on the gap between rich and poor, and whether these ads with the chains falling off are to be believed.
Yes. I was one who very reluctantly supported the GST if it wasn't on food and if there was proper compensation. I was finally convinced, I guess by my brother's arguments, that about 1975, I think the figures were 13% of Australians drew their primary income from government social security or income support. Now it's up around 22% and increasing. And try as you might to increase the tax base through what's clearly the major instrument, legislative instrument of social justice in this nation, and wait for it, it's the Income Tax Assessment Act. If you believe in social justice, that's the most radical social justice instrument, because it's progressive and those who have the most pay the most. Despite my hope that we might be able to reform that, it became increasingly clear that the rich, who were revolting in both senses, with trusts and corporation, negative gearing, Kerry Packer, as we know, has alleged avoidance of up to $260 million thanks to his Bahamas family trust, $260 million of tax he should have paid. There's a wonderful book on this called The Revolt of the Elites by Christopher Lash. He took the title from Ortega Gasset's book in 1932 called The Revolt of the Masses. And Gasset said, the masses are greedy, selfish, self-seeking, envious. They don't have noblesse oblige. Unlike the rich, they don't understand responsibility for citizenship and putting back in. Well, Lash has written a book called The Revolt of the Elites, saying the rich have revolted, saying we don't have any real community obligations anymore. We shop in Singapore, we holiday in Mallorca, or live there if you've got a breathing problem. The rich don't feel ties to pay tax anymore. That noblesse oblige about putting back in is gone. I was discussing, I think, in the car and coming out how Anna Murdoch was reported to say, as one of the reasons for the separation and breakdown of her marriage with Rupert, she was shocked as a young Scot who came out here and felt great indebtedness to this country that Rupert so casually renounced his Australian citizenship to buy more American TV stations. It's not a bad example, if that's right, of the revolt of the elites. You know, you trade in your citizenship, you don't necessarily feel ties to any community. And that revolt was expressed in tax avoidance, and try as they might, the tax base which needed widening wasn't actually being widened. So I reluctantly supported the GST. As to how it's going to affect others, I guess I'm agnostic. I don't know. I'm waiting to see what effect it's going to have.